I'm tired of winter, everybody.
Oh, it's snowing a
it's
lot.
It's snowing a everywhere. Lot everywhere. But you know what? I shouldn't complain because I live in Chicago where we have the equipment for snowing a lot.
It's true. So wait, if we're gonna banter, Jen, we should introduce. Well, first of all, welcome to Fate of Maids, everyone. We're doing it.
Just right there.
Ish. I'm Sarah McLean. I write romance novels and I read romance novels.
I'm a Jennifer Prokop. I'm a romance reader and critic. And
today we have our friend Kate back.
Hi, everyone. Guess what? Number 5. It is officially
There you go. Pink lady jacket in the mail.
It's in the mail. I'm very excited to be here. I'm also concerned that all your listeners are sick of me, so I'm going to try to be super interesting.
It's going to happen.
Not possible. Also, did we talk about, I don't know if we said this on the last episode, but our Derek Craven episode was the most downloaded episode ever of all episodes of Fated Mates in the first week. And that perplexes me no small amount because it was such a weird episode.
You guys thought no one was going to hear it. And you know what? Yeah. I also thought no one was going to hear it, which is probably why I agreed to do it.
Sure. And then Lisa Claypas was like,
no, it's not okay.
I'm listening to it. So we did hear that Lisa listened to it, and we heard that it gave her a great deal of delight. So
my friend Ernie also listened to it. He's never read Dreaming of You. He's read like 2 romance novels, but he's now a diehard Fated Mates listener because he thinks it's hilarious. But he said, he's like, I'm getting it. I'm getting who this Derek Craven guy is. So he was like, he was texting me as he was listening. And then he would like be like, would Derek Craven carry an animal in a bag? And he was like, never. And he's like, I'm just figuring it out from context. And I was like, you know,
fine. That's how we all learn to read, Ernie.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know what? We were doing something educational with that episode, and we had no idea.
We
really didn't. I will say, my best friend, who is best friend Megan, has never read a romance novel written by anyone but me. And so she texted me 2 days ago and was like, well, I bought that Derek Craven book.
Oh, she's going to have all those, like, thoughts in her head when she reads it.
She's like, I'm 25 pages in. He's obviously Tom Hardy.
Yes.
I was like, I'm so glad that you could be with us on this journey, Megan. But also, be prepared. The book was written in 1993. You're getting into the deep end of the pool.
Yes, right. Exactly. Just starting off with the Iron Man.
So I don't know. I mean, if she'd ever said to me, hey, Sarah, what romance novel should I read that you haven't written? I might have said, read Kate Claiborne. But instead, it's Derek Craven. So
I'm very proud to have been a part of that episode. I'm a part of Fated Mates history.
You are. Our that's best. Amazing. Well, and it's obviously because of you, Kate, that it was our most.
Yes, that's everybody heard I was on and downloaded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were like, they needed to bring someone to like keep it straight.
Yeah.
Because
we
would
have enjoyed. I've enjoyed that kind of popularity my whole life. It's just like the high school cafeteria. That's sarcasm, in case it's not coming across on the pod.
It came across fine.
But we are so excited because we get to have you for your 5th time on the show. You're the first one to have hit 5.
What an honor.
I mean, it should be. It should be, really. And then we are very excited to have you for your 2nd time this month, February, Romance Month.
Romance Month.
I mean, that in itself should tell you how much we love you.
Yep.
To talk about your fucking fabulous new book. And I really feel like Kensington should put that on the cover.
Oh,
obviously.
I'll let them know.
Listen, Jeff, talk about a Jen and Sarah rebranding.
My God, I stayed up reading this book until 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was mad at you for how good it is. Like, really, like, hurt.
I think that's a compliment from one writer to another.
It is. It's a compliment. I read it last summer, I think, didn't I, Kate? I can't remember.
And you did it, not long
it was
after
real early in the process. Or, you know, it was like a sort of a, you know, right as you were doing page edits, I think, or whatever it's called. And I just remember thinking, and it kind of happened to me again this, you know, I was rereading for this, and it just, like, swept me away. And I was like,
so beautiful.
So beautiful.
Oh, you guys
She's
are nice.
Such a gorgeous writer. Makes me sick.
That's so nice. Well, I know we're going to talk I know we're going to talk about that specific book more, but you had me on because we had a theme in mind for talking about
keeping us on honest. This book. Keeping us on brand.
I made an agenda.
We started with banter. By the way, if you live in Texas and you're listening to us this week,
oh man, like, we're thinking of you.
Yeah, we're worried about you. We hope you're running your faucets and
stay warm. Yeah.
Yeah, being careful out there.
Yeah. Well, and all of the South. I mean, Louisiana, I saw some pretty scary bridges today they were showing, and Northern Alabama, I think it's going to be.
Somebody on Old School Book Romance Book Club on Facebook said that Arkansas is just like a mess, too. Yeah. So, the Northerners are sending good love, and, you know, I don't know. Don't trust your four-wheel drive means nothing. Hopefully you haven't had to discover that yet. But
yes,
just because you
ice.
Have a big truck with four-wheel drive doesn't mean that you're going to be safe. So stay home.
Yeah. Don't get cocky.
Get under
there.
The covers.
Maybe
don't
we've all cocky. Seen that video of a guy in Nashville with a four-wheel drive just slide right down his block.
Terrible.
I mean, that's what happens when in places where people have big trucks and no snow. It's they're like, oh, it's no problem. I have four-wheel drive. And then they skate away on
Doesn't
the road.
Doesn't work like that.
Oh, so, yeah, stay warm, stay safe.
Listen to this podcast.
If you are snowed in, you can just go right online and order the ebook of Love at First.
Yes, you can.
Right, which is out now.
We are, because we are in the future. Kate,
yes.
Right, that's right. This is chaos.
Your book is out. Instant juggernaut.
Oh, man. I'm excited.
I will say, I remember when I was younger and weather was going to get bad, the kind of planning you would have to do for new books. And now with your Kindle.
It can just be right there.
Yes.
Correct. Yeah.
Right to your down comforter.
Right. Another really exciting thing we should say before we start talking about retellings is that Love Lettering, which is your last year's book, is an Overdrive read.
Yes.
That's so cool. Explain to everybody what that is.
Yeah.
So Overdrive, many libraries across the country and in some other countries too use Overdrive as their like digital library app. So if you belong to a library and you download books for your library, Overdrive is the app that you might use. And Love Lettering is their Together We Read pick for February. So patrons of libraries all across the country can check it out with no wait between February 10th and 24th. So actually, that's when this podcast comes out. That's still on for today. So if your library is participating.
So what you do is you download it and then you turn off your Wi-Fi and then you read it and then you turn on.
I just want to say, if you download on the 23rd, you still get your regular loan time.
All right. Well, then whatever. Don't break rules like me. I'm always like, I got to break all the rules to keep this.
To keep this library book. Yeah.
But it's been very fun. People have been sending me pictures of their library's homepage, like all across the country. And that's really fun. And I just have been having these little moments where I'll be like thinking about like a famous person, I'll be like, I wonder if that person uses their library app. I wondered if, did Dr. Jill Biden see Love Lettering? Because I bet Dr. Jill Biden uses her library app.
And you know what? Course. I bet Dr. Jill Biden also would love. Like, I feel like she would see that and be like, that looks like a fun one. Well, because you saw that video of the two of them and her
addition
to the White House lawn with those giant hearts.
They went on a little walk.
Dr. Jill Biden loves a book called Love Lettering.
Yeah, anyway, Dr. Jill Biden,
let's get it
call
to
me.
Let's get it to her. How do we get it to her?
That's awesome.
But let's talk about retail.
I know, I'm sorry. We have to do a lot of throat clearing at the beginning, Kate. You just got to get used to us.
We're getting comfy.
It's 10 minutes in. Usually we're a solid 15 or 20.
We get so nervous, really, at the beginning of this podcast.
All right. So, but we should talk about retellings first before we talk about specific examples, because I think one of the things that's really, I mean, romance loves a retelling.
Big time.
Romance is almost built on retelling.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that there's different, like, degrees of retelling, maybe, is like a way to put it, right? So for some, it's like a beat for beat. You know, you're really going to read Pride and Prejudice. Like Pride by Ibi Zoboi is a real, like, it's a YA retelling of Pride and Prejudice set in Brooklyn. And a lot of the, like, story beats, like actual plot points, kind of get retold.
Or like a twist, like a Pride and Prejudice, but it's from Darcy's point of view, or Pride and Prejudice, but it's from, you know, Lydia's point of view.
And then in that case, you know, the characters are all often named Darcy, or, right? Like, there's a lot of really straight up, like, they're not even really clues. It's just like, hey, this is what this is. And then you have, I think, on the other end, Kate's book, Love at First, is, I think, playing around with the way I describe it to people is, it's not like the plot retelling. It's the emotions of room. It's like, right, it's like an emotional thing. And you're and I would love for you to talk about it eventually, but I think we're going to talk about retellings first. But I think it's important to say some people might not like retellings because they're thinking, oh, I didn't like Sleeping Beauty, so I wouldn't like this book. And I don't think it has to be that way. I think there's retellings can be really appealing. And sometimes you're reading one and you don't even really know what it is. So.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think sometimes, I think that's true that, like, sometimes people think, oh, I'm not interested in that retelling because I didn't like the original text. But I also think there's a way in which we might be drawn to retellings of things that we didn't quite like.
Sure.
Like, I was thinking, before we recorded today, I was thinking a little bit about the episode you guys did probably a few months ago now with Christina and Lauren about fanfic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking a lot about, like, the intersection between fanfic and retellings, and just like the idea that there are texts that are, like, formative for us, that kind of, like, live in our minds, and we are always, in a sense, like, sort of going over them or going over the themes of them. And, you know, like, what fanfiction does, right, is, like, a story has taken hold of you either because you want a different version of it, so you're gonna write it, or you're gonna write different scenes or whatever. I mean, that makes me think about kind of the range of fan fiction that exists. That's mm-hmm. like alternate universe fan fiction, or kind of in the right. same fan fiction, or whatever. But anyway, I think, I guess, you know, what it made me think about was, like, how stories take hold of us, and, like, why we feel compelled to tell them in different ways or in new ways. And I think that's particularly interesting in romance because, like Sarah said, I mean, romance does a lot of retelling work, right? So I think it's interesting to think about why that is. Like, you know, why is that so central to our genre?
You know, I'm so glad you brought up fanfic, because one of the things that I have been thinking about a lot with retellings is this idea of, you know, when you write a book, we often say, I mean, I always say, like, the book doesn't really exist until somebody's reading it, right? Like, I build the book, and then I set it loose, and then it becomes whatever it becomes without really me having any control over it. I don't know if you feel the same way, but that's really how I feel. It's how I feel every time, you know, some piece of a book becomes really resonates with a lot of readers, for example. And I had no, often it's something that I did not know was going to be the thing that every reader, mm-hmm. you know, was drawn to, but there it is. Like, it just lives in the world as a different creature. And I think that one of the reasons why romance does so much work around retelling, and why fanfic does so much work around retelling, is because we really feel such ownership over the text as readers and over the characters as readers. And fundamentally, we want them done justice. And so maybe there is a sort of sense of, well, I read that one book, right, where that thing happened, and it didn't sit right with me. Mm-hmm. As you said. And so, you know, yes, Lauren, when you reference Lauren's fanfic was about a redo. She rewrote essentially Breaking Dawn, you know, from the moment of their marriage, right? Like, mm-hmm. straight through.
Right.
Because she felt ownership over those characters. And I've been thinking a lot about this in general in the world as we talk about authors who have made, who have, you know, people like J.K. Rowling, who like have written important texts for so many people, and then suddenly you sort of have to reconcile with them. And like, who owns the characters at some point is a question that I think a lot of us are wrestling with, especially now as the world shows us the many faces of authors. Like, gone are the days when like Thomas Pynchon could just like close his door and live his life.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting too, because I mean, we've been talking about retellings, and really in romance, there's sort of like two threads of that, right? Like, one thread is like fairy tales, right? And fairy tales, the sort of ownership question about fairy tales, or the authorship question
about
fairy tales,
right?
But then there's like literary fairy tales. And I mean, in romance, it seems to me, it's like the fairy tale that I see most often is Beauty and the Beast, and the literary text I see most often is Pride and Prejudice. Like, those are the things I see most often.
But I think a third one is pop culture, and I want us to like talk about that too. But I think you're right that it's Beauty and the Beast and Pride and Prejudice.
Do you think it's not Cinderella?
I do not think it's Cinderella.
Because I feel like Cinderella is like it's a cornerstone text in terms of retellings in romance. Like, I feel like often we're not even thinking about Cinderella, and we're writing, you know, poor girl, like billionaire hero, you know, she's down on her luck, he's gonna do everything he can. I mean, like, it basically feels like it's the DNA of that one archetype.
That's a good point. Yeah, Cinderella is a good
point. But I mean, Beauty and the Beast is where, you know, that's where the exciting, like, grovelly,
like a hero archetype versus a heroine archetype.
Yeah, that, like, alpha hero.
I think with Cinderella, it's different for me.
It's real old-fashioned.
Yes. And I also think that she's a character without a lot of agency in the original. And I think that there's a way in which that becomes a hard sell. We don't like to see the heroines as victims.
You just said something interesting, though. You said Cinderella is a heroine archetype, and Beauty and the Beast gives us a hero archetype. And that's actually really interesting. I mean, the Cinderella story does get retold a lot with a Cinderella that has more agency.
Yep, right.
And that hero often in those retellings, the hero is flat. Like, he's kind of a stand-in for any rich hero can sort of, you know, there's that
What's
old...
What's the guy in Cinderella? Who's the guy? It's Prince Charming?
Aren't they all Prince Charming? Have you guys ever heard that Seinfeld bit where he's like...
That's why, to me, a wedding is like the joining together of a beautiful, glowing bride and some guy. The tuxedo is a wedding safety device created by women because they know that men are undependable. So in case the groom chickens out, everybody just takes one step over and she marries the next guy. That's why the wedding vow isn't, do you take Bill Simpson? It's, do you take this man?
That's how it feels with Cinderella. Like, it's this Prince Charming or this other one. Who cares?
Yeah.
We don't want to see Cinderella, like, victimized, but we like to see...
Oh, I want to see the Beast, like, broken down, though. Mm-hmm.
So I do. I think that's part of what's going on there.
And Beauty and the Beast, I mean, the Beauty and the Beast retellings, like, one function that Beauty and the Beast retellings often serve is that they allow that really, like, tight focus on the romance, right? Because in Beauty and the Beast, right, it's like they are in this castle alone, right? Like, all the conflict comes from just, like, you know, just that tight focus. And I think that's really interesting. And so I can kind of see why that's a very popular romance retelling.
Yeah. But here's my question. Like, would we even say, I think when we have this conversation about, like, well, is it Cinderella? Is it Beauty and the Beast? Like, would we even say that Cinderella exists as a retelling in most of these stories? Like, if you don't know, are you retelling it? Right? Like, if the tree falls in the forest, like, if the archetype is there, but you're not thinking about Cinderella, does it mean that you did it or not?
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, that feels like a reader versus writer thing. It's that, you know, Venn diagram, what a writer means, like what your English teacher says a writer means.
Yeah.
Versus what you experience as a reader. You know, one of the things I think about a lot is that in order to qualify as a retelling, I think there are things people are going to look for as markers.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I feel like if, you know, the Cinderella archetype is going to be different than a Cinderella retelling. Mm-hmm. And at some point, if someone's like, look, there's not a ball and there's not a glow up and there's not some fancy shoes,
the glow then up, it's, of course.
Right? Then I'm not going to actually, it's not going to feel as much like a retelling as it would if it's just sort of this character archetype. So I do think when we use the word retelling, a lot of people really are, to me, what that means is without any handholding, readers are going to see what they're reading and they're going to understand. Like I read Zachary Bronson, Where Dreams mm-hmm. Begin, when... And, you know, the minute she goes to his, house and it's, this palace with, the gold butterfly wallpaper, I was like, it's Beast's castle, right? And so I think as readers, retellings often what people like is that moment of, recognition.
Yeah.
I didn't even think that.
Really?
I didn't think when I, but maybe I was, very distracted by everything else about that book though.
But it, for me, it was that moment where he's come live in my house. And then it's this birthday cake of a house, right? To me, it really did feel I literally at the moment where I'm going to find it, I'll put it in show notes, this description of the wallpaper. I was that's Beast Castle right there.
But I mean, Sarah, you've put a lot of fairy tale stuff in your book. So when you do it, what do you feel like you're doing as the author?
I guess I have. This most recent series, The Barnacle Bastards, I have, right? The first book was Rumpelstiltskin, and I wanted it to... I was like, Rumpelstiltskin is amazing. What happens if you take... The concept for that series, though, was very, I wanted to play with this idea of, anti-heroes. Devil is such... all of them are such anti-heroes that it felt there are all these... There are all these fairy tales where there is a villain, and what if the villains were the heroes, right? And so that first book is Rumpelstiltskin, and I did it intentionally, but I didn't want it to be the story. I'm not interested in an overt retelling, right? It's not interesting to me to tell.
She's not trapped in a room spinning shit into,
No, I mean, talk gold, about right? a character with no agency, right? She literally can't do anything without this, goblin person, right? Yeah. But I really wanted, I liked that idea of, imagine getting yourself into the exact worst possible situation and then having somebody who made you slightly nervous or very nervous turn up in the dead of night and promise you that he could fix it for you, right?
Right.
And how that could be incredibly sexy too, because obviously I'm a troubled mind. but for me, I think that there are lots of fairy tales in my books by virtue of me writing romance novels, and fairy tales just exist in the romance world. But for me, my books are really about myth and retelling, retelling mythology, the retelling work that myth does. And I'm really fascinated, and I know you are too, Kate, about with this idea of at what point does the story not, I mean, as I said earlier, at what point does the story not belong to the author, one? But then on the next level, at what point does the story get to be just sort of constantly changed? At what point do I get to say, that's actually not how the myth went at all. This is how it went instead. And I think when you go back to these, formative texts in whatever culture, and you say, this text is... 4,000 years old, and it's been retold two dozen times or more, hundreds of times, always with, in many cases, with Greek and Roman myth, with the heroines dying or, some sort of tragic thing happening to the women in the story. At what point do I get to say, that's 4,000 years old, and the 201st retelling is going to be mine, and I'm going to shift it around?
I'm really fascinated by stories that exist not just in one culture, but in multiple cultures. So everyone has heard me say my favorite book to teach is this book, House of the Scorpion. And everyone has also heard me talk about, like, my rules of symbolism that I teach kids, right? And number one is animals are always symbols. And number two is fairy tale figures and mythological creatures are always symbols. And in this book, one of the stories that gets told is the story of La Llorona, which is essentially the weeping woman. And it's a story about a woman who kills her own children to get back at her bad husband. And I talked to the kids about Medea, not that, right? Like that there's something really frightening in about a woman who refuses to nurture. And every culture has a story that is like grappling with this like big question, right? What are you going to do when you have a mother who won't mother? And then I talk about Andrea Yates, who's a woman who, because of postpartum psychosis, killed her own children. I mean, and I know this is like with seventh graders, and trust me, it's all great and the kids are not terrified. But I think it's really interesting to talk about, I don't know, like culturally, not just like who owns the story when it comes to individuals, but like who owns the story? Like, why do these stories even exist at like a meta level? And why, which stories are the ones that really like stick with us? Like, why do we have 800 million Beauty and the Beast and, you know, and Cinderella retellings, but only a handful, if we could even name more, of Rumpelstiltskin ones in romance? Like, what is it about the DNA of certain stories that like funnels down? Maybe horror has lots of Rumpelstiltskin retellings.
I imagine it must, right? But also to your point, you know, you can blow that out into far beyond the fairy tale, right? Like in mythology, I mean, there must be 200,000 Hades and Persephone retellings in romance in the last year.
Yes.
I mean, everyone
it's gotten really popular.
This story. For the same reason, it's like the push-pull. There's also a safety to it, which I think is what you're getting at when you talk about like mothers who don't nurture is a terrifying story. But in storytelling, there's a barrier, right?
Yes.
It goes back to what Dr. Jennifer Lynn Barnes talks about when she talks about universal ids, which I think we talked about like way back, maybe on season one here. But she has this, she does a lot of her, she's a professor in Oklahoma, and she does a lot of her work around popular fiction and the brain and why certain books become popular, become bestsellers. And her concepts, you know, she's done tons and tons of research with readers and whatever, and she came up with these kind of six universal ids, like things that essentially push our pleasure buttons as humans. And one of the things she talks about is danger being one of those things. But of course, it's not really dangerous to read about danger. It's very safe right. to read about danger, but it still scratches that itch for us. And so I think, you know, in romance, we're constant. That's why Hades and Persephone, for example, or Beauty and the Beast really work well for so many of us, because there's that sort of threat of what's it going to be like? And, you know, is he a monster? And, you know, what happens to me when I'm in hell, or what happens to me when I'm finally in the castle alone? But of course, you're safe, because at the end, you're going to fall in love.
It's really interesting to think about, like, the intersection in romance between like retelling and sort of trope. Like, trope is such an important language for romance readers. But like, when we talk about retellings, is that somehow different from trope? Are they all overlapping? I mean, I can say for myself as a reader, like, I really like retellings. Like, if somebody like gets on the timeline and advertises their book as like it's this sort of retelling, I'm like, oh, I'm interested.
Yeah,
in
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm interested in storytelling. I'm interested in like narrative style or whatever. So the fact that I know something is a retelling is going to be interesting to me.
Well, we talk so much about like we're all so interested in craft. This sort of requires a sort of a deep craft.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm always interested in it for those reasons too. But then, of course, like within the sort of like universe of retellings, as you guys said, there's like some things that will appeal to me more than others. And that certainly has to do with trope, right? Like, and so I'm kind of interested in how those things intersect a bit, right? Like, Beauty and the Beast retelling, is that a trope in and of itself, or is that retelling embedded within it? Are there a bunch of tropes that we are?
Is it possible that when it's done so many times, like at some point, it just becomes owned by us as a trope?
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, it's the Beauty and the Beast trope. Like, it's not even a retelling anymore.
As a genre, we've claimed it. It's ours. On the horror side, it's a retelling for them, but it's not a trope for them. Or maybe it is. I don't know. If you know a lot about horror, tell us. But I'm thinking right now, in answer to your question, I'm thinking about something like Pygmalion, right? Which feels so, I mean, it's My Fair Lady, right? So it feels like we've seen it 1,000 times, redone in different ways. And I think about Judith Ivory's The Proposition, which is famously like a rat catcher hero and a heroine who makes a deal to present him as an aristocrat and convince essentially London that he is not a rat catcher, right? I mean, it's reverse Pygmalion. And I think that's, in that particular case, it's so clearly a retelling of the original. But certainly, like, maybe Pygmalion is in the trope of the glow-up always.
Mm-hmm. I agree, but I think for me the interesting question becomes, like, not, like, both, like, what has to be there, but also, like, what are the parts that are changeable? And then those seem to be the things that are, like, really responsive to, like, who we are now. So, like, the glow-up maybe is always a part of it, but, like, what's being glowed
right.
up, right? Is mm-hmm. it just your, is it clothes? Is it your house? Is it your physical looks? Is it, I mean, I don't know. Like, I feel like maybe, is it your intelligence, your educational background? I mean, I remember when I heard Ibi Zoboi talk about Pride, which is a Pride and Prejudice retelling, and she talked about how education had to be essentially what, like, education was sort of the thing that they were after, because that right now is the right. And then it was like a gentrification story. But she talked about, like, I had to really think about how was I going to make this story modern? Like, what were the things that would have to be, that would have to change?
Yeah. Which I think is why it goes back to what Kate was saying, the why it's so fascinating when somebody takes on a text that is so known. Right? Because I think you can take on something like Pygmalion or Hades and Persephone or any number of myth or Beauty and the Beast or whatever and do it fine because it's just sort of in the ether, right? But I think it takes a lot of chops to take Pride and Prejudice and, like, truly renovate it in the way that Pride does or in the way that Sonali Dev does. I think it takes a lot of chops to take Shakespeare and, like, truly renovate it. And I think it's hard to do. Like, there was a time in the 80s and 90s when a lot of people were doing Taming of the Shrew. And, like, now I think it's a lot harder to do Shrew. Like, that's not a great model for a modern romance, right? And I know, and I want to call out, Nisha Sharma is doing it right now, and her book, Dating Dr. Dill, is coming out. And I'm, you know, I trust Nisha implicitly to be able to pull this off, but I think it takes chops. Which is why I think retellings can be so hit or miss when you're really doing a beat for beat version.
Yes. Right.
Because I don't want to read Pride and Prejudice again. I have read the original, right? I want to read Pride and Prejudice, but a new version. Something that makes me think about it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something we haven't really said, right? It's like a great retelling will not only sort of live with you in the moment of the retelling, but it will...
Yeah.
Sort of illuminate the original.
Yeah, it will live with alongside your perspective of the original text. I mean, like a great retelling does that. And I think there are texts like that. I mean, I think that, I mean, of course, because we're on a podcast, I can't think of one immediately, but I will.
We'll get there, yeah.
But, you know, like, there are texts that, you know, sort of original texts that now when I think of them, I think of them alongside. Yeah.
Can I tell you, for me, the pair that always comes to mind is Emma and
Oh,
Lewis.
I mean, that's a perfect one.
Oh, yeah, that's a great, yes,
well,
absolutely.
And teenage movies do that, right? Because there's also 10 Things I Hate About You and Taming of the Shrew. And, like, it's perfect. It's a perfect way of redoing it in a high school. I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that. I think that retellings can be really fascinating that way.
Yeah, I agree. Before we like kind of talk about Kate's book, I want to talk about one other thing I think about a lot when I think about retellings. I was telling Kate this before I started. If you've ever read the story or the novel Harun and the Sea of Stories by Salman Rushdie, it's actually a kid's book. It's like for like, you know, young teenagers, I guess I'd say, like not little kids. And he wrote, it's the first book he wrote after the Satanic Verses and after going into hiding. And he was separated from his children. It's honestly a kind of an amazing story. And he wrote this book about a boy and his father who go on like a magical journey to essentially the Earth's like hidden moon. So, you know, this is like hardwired for me to love a lot of this shit. And a lot of it is like retelling. A lot of it leans really hard into the Arabian Nights, like stories from the Arabian Nights. But on this like Earth's third moon, which is called Kani, which means story, there's the story ocean. And the story ocean is like full of story streams. And one way you get a story is like special fish in the ocean, like mix up stories and a new story comes out. And then though, there's like parts of the ocean that are like old and abandoned, right? Like stories that are so old, no one likes to visit them anymore. And I always think of that as being like, you know, when you're like channel surfing and some 50s movie comes on and you're like, who watches these anymore? Right? But then the way it's explained is like, but you could pull one of those stories out, right? And mix it with something new and revitalize it. And then this story that has been around for ages becomes something new and interesting again. And I always thought it was a really beautiful metaphor for just like how story works in general, right? That any old story can be pulled out of that like sort of dead zone of the ocean and brought back to life by a devoted storyteller.
Yeah. I love that image, that metaphor. That's really beautiful.
It is. And if you read that book as like a metaphor for being separated from your kids after
having a fatwa against you, yes. I also think that there's something to be said for loving a thing when you're retelling it. And I think this is where maybe it deviates from trope. Like, we can love the trope, right? But, I mean, I don't have, like, a deep abiding passion for Beauty and the Beast, despite having written several Beauty and the Beast stories. Like, I think that it takes, again, a certain kind of love for a text for you to do it the kind of justice that a retelling often requires to be elevated. And I'm going to use this as my segue to get into Kate's book, because I think it's incredibly clear that you have an abiding love for Romeo and Juliet in this book. I mean, it's magnificent. And I have not read Romeo and Juliet since I was probably in college, definitely in college. And there were just so many moments where I was like, oh my gosh, like this is so evocative of the original, like of the source material, but not at all a retelling in some way. Like, it's not a beat for beat retelling. It's just it's a love letter, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, it is. This is a text that, I mean, Romeo and Juliet is a text that means a lot to me. And I would say, I think, you know, what we've been talking about with retellings, I think some people sort of come to the idea of doing a retelling and they're like, I love the Beauty and the Beast trope, or I love the Hades and Persephone story or whatever. I love Romeo and Juliet, but also I feel like, you know, when people say they have like baggage with a text, I feel like people have like a trunk full of baggage about Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
And I think that's like I think that's like times a thousand in the romance community. And I guess what I would say is like, I think one reason a lot of us have baggage with it is like, this is a text that many of us are forced to read. I think many of us are forced to read it too early in our lives. Like I have sort of strong feelings about that, but, also like, I know that, you know, when I have been, sort of like parts of conversations in the romance community or sort of, witnesses to conversations in the romance community about this text, I know that like one of the ways that we talk about this text is how frustrating it is that people call Romeo and Juliet a romance, right? And whenever it happens, romance readers are like, oh my God, it's not a romance. and it's not, right? And Shakespeare would also say it is not. I guess I've always been like interested in that sort of discourse because Romeo and Juliet is not a romance. But I still really love this text, like deeply love it. And I think it is, it's painful to me to hear people say, this is a story about kind of like foolish people doing foolish things. Because, you know, they're kids.
They
are intense. And that's what it's like to be a kid. And they aren't just kids, but they also are, like, kids that are surrounded by, like, violence.
Well, talk about a community of extra people, right? Like, everyone's extra in this play.
And, you know, like, it's this really damaged world that is, like, full of some of the most gorgeous poetry. In all of Shakespeare. I mean, Romeo and Juliet has really beautiful poetry. And so I guess I thought when I had the idea for this book, you know, some of it was like images that I had in my head that are really like, as you guys were talking about before, like pop, very clear to pop culture, like balconies and things like that. But for me, I just sort of had this question I kept coming back to, which was like, you know, what if Romeo and Juliet had not met as teenagers? Like, what if they had been allowed to grow up? Like, what kind of people would they have become? And so I wanted to think about that. But I also wanted this, the book that I wrote to have very sort of quiet, moments of tribute to spots of Romeo and Juliet that I think are really beautiful, like really beautifully written, really romantic.
It's romantic, right? Like that's the thing. It's not a romance, but it's romantic.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's fair for people to say it's not romantic because they're just kids.
I don't know.
That's really fair to say.
That palm to palm moment is real romantic. I mean, that's and also appreciating that they are just kids, like. Don't discount those like big emotions that you have when you are 14 years old. Like it feels I have read my diaries from when I was 14 years old and it feels like that. It feels like I could die for this person.
Yeah.
I will die for you.
I think and I also think romance is like you know, often what we are doing is we are like we are telling adult versions of that intensity, right?
Yes.
Like people feeling intensely. And so, I don't know, I think in Love at First, like when you first meet the characters, so there's a prologue to this book, and when you first meet the characters, Will, who is the hero of this book, is 15 years old, and he's really restless, like young Romeo is, and he's really distractible.
He has a wandering eye.
Yes, he has a wandering eye. He's nearsighted, so he doesn't see things clearly, which is sort of, I mean, he literally doesn't see things clearly, but that's also metaphor of being young and confused about the world around you. And he sees a girl on a balcony and just falls in love instantly. But things change such that they don't meet at that moment and they get to grow up and meet each other again later. So I guess all throughout the book, like what I'm trying to do is offer little touchstones to Romeo and Juliet, while not retelling the story.
Do you have, and maybe this is a question that is too spoilery or that you would rather not answer, and that's fine, but do you have a moment that you knew you wanted to put in the book as an homage?
Yeah, I mean, there are many. I think that it is true that when I wrote it, I thought, if nobody gets it, like, you know, I didn't intend it, like, anybody who picks this up will see it's Romeo and Juliet. Like, that wasn't really, and when I turned it in, my editor, like, did say to me, like, you know that a lot
people,
of this.
It's going to, right, they're not going to notice.
It isn't that I think, you know, people won't get it, but, like, some of the stuff is subtle enough that, like, if you haven't read the text very recently, like, it won't necessarily strike you, but I will say that, like, early in the book, I have a scene that does sort of try to replicate the palm-to-palm moment in Romeo and Juliet, where, like, early on in Romeo and Juliet, when they touch palms, and this is almost like it's a holy experience for them. It's a sacred experience for them. And I knew I wanted that, something like that in the book. So that's there, right? And that's pretty early.
God,
I don't think
that's
a spoiler.
They don't kiss.
I know.
They don't.
I mean, no, eventually.
It's a slow burn because I wrote it.
Yeah, sure.
In that moment, oh my God, I feel all that. Somehow, this is the first time I got real mad, because somehow in this moment where their palms touch, you feel all that, like, pent up, like, heat that teenagers feel in that moment of, like, oh my God, he's touching me, right? But they're, like, normal grown-ups having a mostly normal moment. And it's just so intense and incredible. And you're magnificent. You're the best writer.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. I feel like it's the most romantic book that I've ever written. And I think the reason for that is because, like, what I wanted to explore was, like, you know, particularly Will, like, he feels like he's grown up. So he's let go of that intensity. Like, he sees that as part of his past. He's not that person anymore. And, you know, like, then as the book goes on, it was like, what if I get to lean into that intensity? Like, he's still that way. He still feels things that intensely. But he's grown, and it doesn't have to be unhealthy. It doesn't have to be sort of scary, like it is in Romeo and Juliet, where you have a sense of doom coming at you all the
time. Well, and that's because of his parents, too, right? And I thought that was one thing that I thought was really interesting is, you know, part of the reason Romeo and Juliet is so tragic is because they're parentless in the sense, right? Like, you're like, these parents just want to war with each other more than they want to, like, love their kids.
Yeah.
And I found, you know, and of course in Romeo and Juliet, you're just like, oh, okay. But, like, in Will's case, you know, his parents, I don't want to spoil it, but they are just, they're going through some things. And he feels like he's not a part of that because he isn't. And it's hard to read because then you're like, but it's like the heart of the book too.
This other piece that almost is a flip of Romeo and Juliet as I remember it, and tell me if I'm wrong, which is this community piece, right? Like, these two people have this vibrant, supportive community around them. This, so we haven't really talked about the premise of this book at all, but yeah, let's talk about the book's about.
Oh, yeah, you want me to say something?
Yeah, you should say that. Yeah.
So, I mean, I said a little bit about the prologue, but where that leads is that, you know, this woman, Nora Clark, she has inherited an apartment from her grandmother where she spent every summer of her young life. This is a very close-knit apartment building, so it's a six-flat unit in Chicago. All six of the apartments are owned by people who have been there for a long time, and they're a very close-knit community. And so she is now living in this apartment because her grandmother has passed away. Another resident in the apartment has recently passed away and left his apartment to Will. And Will would like to rent this unit out as a short-term, sort of like
a Airbnb.
Like an Airbnb style. And because Nora really doesn't want that, she wants to preserve this sort of perfect community that was really important to her grandmother, she decides she's going to try to sort of sabotage him a bit. And that's a bit of like the sort of two houses, both alike. And so she thinks she's going to sabotage him.
Oops.
But in fact, she falls in love with him. So,
but part of the plan for sabotage involves these four other residents, the four other flats in the building, where there are elderly residents, largely elderly residents, who are sort of also annoyed by the idea of this Airbnb and deeply, deeply loyal to Nora and to the man who lived in the apartment before Will. And so they are all kind of they're like around a lot and they're helping with the sabotage. And like, you know, one of my favorite moments is when like the two old ladies knock on his door as he's trying to like dump his, like literally throw out his uncle's, you know,
get
stuff.
Rid of things.
And they're like, we brought hot dish.
It just feels,
because it feels unlike, you know, in Romeo and Juliet, where it felt like the two of them against the world. In this case, it's like the two of them and the whole world is there for them. Like they're at some point, they are part of this much larger supportive community. And it's so beautiful.
This is different from Romeo and Juliet, but this is also a bit of a homage to Romeo and Juliet, because in Romeo and Juliet, there are older members of their community
that were
good to them. So the nurse for Juliet, the friar. And I think that something I thought about was like, what if those characters were sort of multiplied and sort of fuller and surrounding them. And, you know, I thought about like the nurse in Romeo and Juliet is very funny. And she's a little bawdy. And I knew that I wanted the characters that surrounded Nora, particularly in the building, I wanted them to feel like that, right? There's no proper analog for the nurse, but in some ways they're all the nurse in a way. So I thought about that too. I guess what I would say is like, I wrote this book with Romeo and Juliet beside me. Like, I mean, it was really important to how I crafted the book. So it wasn't just like the big idea in my head, like star-crossed lovers or something like that. It was like very small details that I tried to weave into.
Like the language makes its way into the book, the way that it's really lovely.
And like, you know, Nora's name, this is like one thing that I think is, you know, some things I think folks will find for themselves or not find for themselves. And it does, I hope it doesn't matter either way, but like, you know, Nora's name, means like ray of sunshine. And that is because Romeo says like, it is the East and Juliet is the sun. And so that is why I picked Nora's name. So all these little subtle things, you know, I was going to say it made it fun to write, but like nothing is fun for me to write, but it's, you know, like it was compelling and it was interesting and it was challenging for me as a writer.
So can I tell you what I tell my students about like when they're reading something like this? Cause I teach them about like symbolism and I feel like this is a really good way to talk to people about this. And Sarah, actually, you don't know this, but you are a star of this made-up story. So what I tell kids is I was like, my friend Sarah loves to cook and I don't. And if we go to a restaurant together, she's one of those people who's like, oh, there's like a hint of rosemary. And I am the person who's like, I don't know what you're talking about. But I can still tell that I ate a delicious meal, even if I do not know the ingredients that went into it the same way that Sarah does. And when you read a book like this, you can tell that it's delicious, right? You can tell that the author has carefully crafted and prepared this meal that you are about to read. Even if you can't tell or don't care to, if you just want to like read it and say, I still had a great meal, right? Yeah. It doesn't matter if I can't identify the parts. And I think it's a really useful way, like reading, sometimes we're in the mood to like look for the right? To look for palm to palm. And sometimes we just want to read it because it's delicious. And both of those things are okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what I will say is I'm extremely basic when it comes to Romeo and Juliet. Like, extremely basic. To the point where I was like, I'm going to read this book and I'm not going to understand any of the references, and I'm going to be really sad because, like, my friend wrote this great book and I don't understand all of it. And then I was like, so first of all, I can confirm that you will love this book even if you don't get all the references. But also, I don't think it's obscure. I think there are some moments, like, I think beginning with the balconies, you're sort of like, ooh, I get it, right? Like, I get it. And then, of course, palm to palm, I was like, come on, this lady, she's so good.
When we were talking about the romance retellings in general, and, like, Jen mentioned pop culture, balconies are... That is now like a pop culture
staple. Yeah.
So it's like,
oh yeah,
you can see sort of like a balcony as a romantic set, and it has nothing to do with Romeo and Juliet, right? Like, but.
Well, except it kind of did, right?
It becomes cultural, right?
This goes back to that, like, is it a retelling if there's a balcony on it?
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, no.
Yeah.
But in Kate's case, yes.
The power of like myth and symbol. It is part of the culture, even if you don't know the source material.
Yeah.
You know, kids know that snakes have a certain profile, even if they've never read the Adam and Eve story. And so I think that that's the thing that I find fascinating about retellings is you're sort of making the invisible visible, right? You're pulling it back up again and saying like, no, I really want to talk about the balconies, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that how symbols like that get adopted and transformed are interesting. I mean, like, you know, now it's like balconies are like seen as a romantic symbol. But there's like complication to this, right? Like, is that because scenes where a balcony feature, is it like that a woman is being put on a pedestal? It is not really about who she is, but about like what she represents to like the person who is gazing at her. Like, so even these things that are very familiar to all of us have depth that we don't often, right, think about. And I love a story that gives me the opportunity to think about stuff like that. Hopefully Love at First will do that for people. But if it doesn't, I hope it's just a good story, right? Like, I hope it's just a good romance.
So we're going to all talk about some other retellings. We've mentioned a few. We talked about Kate's. I know that we're like at an hour, so we'll probably each just mention.
I would say two of mine are like literary retellings. Sarah already mentioned one, which is the Sonali Dev series that's going on right now, right? So she has done a Pride and Prejudice one, a Persuasion one. She's got a new one, Incense and Sensibility.
It's great.
I think that, yeah, I mean,
such a good title.
Sonali's writing is just so layered. And it's also, I mean, for me at least, like, I'm gonna feel feelings when I read Sonali. So like, I think her writing is really evocative. And I think that's particularly well suited to retellings. And I think that series is really impressive. So that's one that comes to mind. I also think there's a lot of interesting Shakespeare retellings out there. Recently, Loretta Chase had one that was like, now I'm going to forget the title, but it's like 10 Things I Hate About the Duke, I think. And what's interesting about it is that it is both a Taming of the Shrew retelling and a 10 Things I Hate About You sort of.
Which is fascinating, right? When you retell the retelling.
Yeah, so there's like a couple of interesting things going on there. So I think that's really interesting.
And you know, Loretta's one of those writers who like, there's no way she didn't know exactly what she was doing.
And there are characters that show up in there that you think, it's sort of like you have this tentative, like you feel a tentative echo about the text. You're like, is this... And yeah, like it probably is, right? She's doing something interesting, but it's not, it's, you don't have to know it to enjoy the text itself. So those are a couple. I have some pop culture ones too, but I'll save those for now.
Okay. Well, we come back to.
Okay.
I am going to talk about It Takes Two to Tumble by Cat Sebastian, which is a Sound of Music retelling. Although I've got to tell you, here's the other thing. It's not really a retelling. I would say it's more like, it's like the Big Bang, right? So it's like the characters have a very similar setup because one hero, Philip, and I'm really embarrassed. I was going to ask Sarah beforehand. I don't know how to say his last name. I'm confused by it as an American. So it's like the word acre, but with a D in front. But I'm like, it can't be Dacre, but is it like Descartes? I have no idea.
But you know what? This is one of the worst things about like when you read and you're just like, I wish I could hear somebody say this out loud.
I know.
What is this person? This is why you need Robert Petkoff for all things.
Everybody with Viscount for like the first 10 years of their reading life.
Oh, I am like girding my loins for the next the Viscount question.
Get ready now. It's true. Okay. Philip is a sea captain and he's at sea. His wife has died. He has 3 kids at home who are apparently like wild ones. And the love of his life was like his first mate who died 14 months ago at sea, and he had to like bury him at sea. Whoa. So he returns home and the like local vicar is watching the children. And so I was immediately like, is this the Sound of Music? It's like the sea captain and the vicar. It was also delightful.
I want this immediately.
Yes. And I was like, it was delightful though to also, I wasn't expecting it. So it was like that discovery moment and it, you know, that's it. Like they're not running away from Nazis, like, but it's just that immediate setup of my children are wild. And the like young, handsome vicar is the one who understands them. And, you know, and it's terrific. You know, they climb trees and they're wild, but that's really it. And then it's really the story of, you know, really diverts from like the plot of The Sound of Music from there. But that setup was there. And it was a really delightful book. And I just loved that sense at the beginning of like, wait, terse sea captain who doesn't, you know, he's going to be so difficult with the children. He doesn't know how to handle them. And The Sound of Music was very formative for me, so I just got to tell you.
Are there any clothes made out of curtains?
No, not to my memory, but I would have to go back and do a...
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was great.
Before you do another one, can I do obscure children's movie slash romance novel retelling? Once upon a time, there was a announcement in Publishers Marketplace, which is the like industry email blast that goes out every day that announces the new deals and the books that are going to be published in the next, you know, however many years. And it was called Charlene and the Chocolate Factory. And it was a Regency romance acquired by Avon. And I was like, hang on a minute. And that book ultimately was not titled that. And it ended up being called How the Duke Was Won. And it's by Lenora Bell. And it is a romance retelling of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
What? I love it.
It's basically like a bachelorette style.
Right.
Like, situation where there's a competition for a duke's, you know, essentially for a title and an estate, and he owns a cocoa farm. It's not a plantation, but it is a cocoa farm, and he is like importing essentially like free trade, like safely farmed, you know, ethically farmed cocoa into England and Europe. And these 4 heiresses, they go to his home for 3 days.
Is Amazing. He super weird? Is he super weird?
And he's super crusty. He's very, closed, buttoned up. And so he's not, like...
He's not, like, Wonka.
He's not weird. He's not, like, singing at you with his crazy eyes. But, like, he's very buttoned up. And then the heiresses do kind of, like... peel off in interesting manners. Right. So, so the heroine is not, she is there, she's faking it. She is there as, she's pretending to be her cousin. But it is delightful. It's Lenora Bell's debut. And it really, I think, put a stake in the ground for her. But also, I'll never forget reading Charlene in the Chocolate Factory and being like, hang on a second.
That's amazing.
You both of yours are really good.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because there are two other authors I wanted to mention who I think just do so many of them and so well. And that's Eloise James, who has a whole series of, you know, but almost like to the point where I was looking and I was like, I don't know which one to talk about. So I'll just talk about Eloise James. And then Laura Florin wrote a whole series that I also think the ones set in Paris, like the chocolate ones. Aren't those
the chocolate ones?
There's like they're fairy little fairy tales,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think they're not like beat for beat necessarily, but I just think that they're inspired.
Eloise James, I just want to say, has two famous retelling series. There's the fairy tale series, which is the one everybody points to. My favorite of that series is When Beauty Tamed the Beast, which is also, interestingly, kind of a retelling of House, the TV show, but also Beauty and the Beast, which is fascinating. And I think, like, pitch perfect for both. And then her Essex Sisters series is actually a Little Women retelling in Georgian England.
But they're all Shakespeare, too.
Oh, wait. It's Little Women and Shakespeare. So like, yeah, you're right.
You know, one
are the
like
stories a... Shakespeare? I know the titles are all Shakespeare.
Yeah, like even the one where she's in Scotland. I forget which one that's called.
We'll figure it out and put it.
But that's a bit of like Taming of the Shrew stuff. I mean, I think there's resonances.
Well, Eloisa is also a Shakespeare professor, so Shakespeare sort of threaded through all of her books.
I think the house example is good because, I mean, that's what I was saying about like another, some of mine were like pop culture ones that I think are interesting. Like Andy Christopher, It's Not the Girl You Marry, is like 10 Things I Hate About You. The Eva Lee series, that is, I think the most recent one is coming out, but they're all, these 80s movies, right? So, I mean, I think it's like an interesting feature of the genre, sort of like where it will mine for storytelling. I just think that's really fascinating. And pop culture, which is probably not widely considered as like ripe for retelling, right? Because we think of pop culture as like low in some ways, right? I love that authors are like taking on pop culture as a retelling feature, especially because the distinction between high and low culture is entirely false. So I really love that.
Well, and I think Lenora Bell has lots of them. I mean, the one where it's the heroine's name is Mina Penny and she wants to be a spy is like such a straight up like Monty Penny, Bond James. And again, I was delighted by it when I read it.
I've vaguely talked about this book before, but I can't do retelling without talking about it, and that's Astrid Glen Gray's Brearley, which is, I mean, pretty much a Beauty and the Beast retelling in World War II France. And except instead of Beauty being the one who falls in love with the Beast, it's the parson father. Her father's a parson, and he gets abducted into the Beast's castle. And it's this magical castle, and he falls in love with the Beast. So it's really, like, delicious and different and so atmospheric. And this is one of the things that I talked about Honey Trap 2 on our Best of the Year episode last year. And there's something about Astrid Glen Gray's writing that's just so atmospheric. You really feel like you're in the, you know, the French, you know, countryside in this book. So yes. And then I think it's important for us to sort of name check erotica here because so much erotic romance is retelling focus. And I'm thinking about there's an anthology of erotic short stories called Dark Fairy Tales, which I don't think is available anymore. But we'll put link in show notes to at least the list of stories, because I think a lot of them have been republished by the authors, where every story was written, you know, the brief for the anthology was you have to retell a story. So C.R. Simone, for example, did the dancing one, the one with the dancing princesses, I think, which I didn't know that at all was a fairy tale, but sure enough it is. And then Sophie Jordan did Goldilocks and the Three Bears for hers. I mean, like, really fun, different ways of looking at fairy tales as being sexy. And then I would also just, and both of them, both Sierra and Sophie, do lots of retellings. Like, Sierra's probably most famous project is the new Camelot series, which is a modern retelling of Arthurian legend. And then Sophie, of course, wrote While the Duke Was Sleeping, which is a retelling of While You Were Sleeping.
Those are all really good.
And my favorite review of that book is on Amazon. Somebody's like, this seems very similar to While You Were Sleeping movie. Jen's always like, some people aren't close readers.
Some people just want to eat a delicious meal, everybody.
I'm just thinking I could remember, Sarah, when you said erotica, I can remember one. And this was so long ago that I would have to go back and like see about it. But I remember this book by a writer. Her name is Betty Sharp. And it was this book called Ember. And it was a Cinderella. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yep.
It's been a long time since I've thought of that. But I remember this like very clearly as a really, I mean, it's told as a fair, like there's a Prince Charming, but I remember it being like really different.
And I mean, it almost feels like we can't do this without, and I can't believe it wasn't the first thing on my list, but it's not a romance. It is pure erotica, but the Sleeping Beauty Chronicles by Anne Rice, writing under whatever that other name was that she wrote under. You're both giving me like blank faces.
I don't know that one. Here's a deep cut, everybody.
Obviously, Kate.
Kate.
I don't think I'll go there.
It's not for you. Anne Rice in the 90s wrote a series of like true erotica called The Sleeping Beauty Chronicles
by A.N. Roculaire.
There you go. And they are in many ways troubling. Like, this is not romance, but it's basically like, if I remember correctly, like Sleeping Beauty is like abducted into this like world of like just sexual excess and pleasure and pain. Like, I mean, like there's a lot, it's deep look into Anne Rice's, you know, what scratches itch, I think. But there are maybe four of them, and they were like passed around at Smith as like, everybody had to read these. They were like, I think pretty new at the time, and they are startling.
This is extremely not what happened to me in college.
Yeah. Yeah, they came out in 1983.
Oh, they're much older. Yeah, no, they were probably, yeah. I mean, but I feel like this is one of those moments where it was like the first time I had ever been exposed to this idea of picking up a character that was widely known to be, in this case, like without agency and basically, I mean, Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, right.
My daughter is constantly saying like, Sleeping Beauty does nothing. She just goes to sleep at the beginning of the movie and it's all Maleficent. Right? Yeah. Like, and that's true. But in this particular case, like, Anne Rice is doing something completely different with this character. And I think erotica does that, right? Like, Katie Robert is doing that now with other Disney people. And like, there's something about that kind of, maybe it is all about that sort of really visceral response to these fairy tale ideas.
You know, there's so much, it's really interesting. We're talking about retellings. Like, as we've been talking, like, something has really coalesced for me, which is that, like, retellings are really, like, a really strong intersection of, like, you know, you just said, like, a visceral response or, like, an emotional connection to a text intersecting with craft, right? Like, you know, something that, a story that has stuck with you or that is important to you or that is formative for you, coming together with what you can do craft-wise to make that story new. I think that's really, you know, fascinating. Maybe it's something all authors, you know, get interested in doing at some point.
Yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about how in the before times, like before we had the internet, before we had Twitter, before we were all kind of in each other's aware of what everybody else was writing all the time, there had to have been a moment where those kind of early writers were reading each other and kind of becoming so influenced by each other that the books all evolved similar stories in different ways. Yeah. Right. And one of the things that I didn't get to talk too much about, and I appreciate we're over time, is this question of, like, none of us have really talked about about retelling a romance novel, right? Like, about saying, well, I really loved Lord of Scoundrels, so I'm going to write that again. Like, I'm going to retell A Kingdom of Dreams. And I think that I wonder if we're doing that subconsciously. When we write, some of us, I wonder if any of us are doing, I certainly am doing, like, there are definitely moments, like we talked about, Brazen and the Beast begins in a way that is very, it's sort of an homage to Suddenly You.
Right.
But it doesn't go much further than that kind of beginning. I wonder, I feel like Tessa Dare is probably in those early books was in many ways, like, writing homage to Julia Quinn, who came before her, right?
That is interesting.
You've just blown my mind.
I know, me too.
I guess my question is there a reason why we don't talk about retelling other romance novels the way we talk about retelling other things? Like, we're allowed to retell, you know, Emma. If we're allowed to retell, I don't know, while You Were Sleeping, why couldn't we retell A Kingdom of Dreams?
That's really interesting. I don't know if it's like goes back to what we were saying at the beginning about like trope. Is it that because the genre, like a part of the language of the genre is about trope?
Yeah.
I don't know. Listen. Why'd you have to end it like this?
I'm just here to blow your mind. I'm here to blow your mind. Come back. Time number six. Yeah. Figure it out. Come back and tell us.
That's a big question. It is true. I'm like, I'm just going to have to sit with that for a while.
I mean, because surely we're all doing it, right?
Yeah.
Like,
well, but I think you're right. I think it downshifts to tropes, like a straight up retelling.
Is it overt is the question. Like, at what point are we allowed to do it?
Yeah. That's fascinating.
But it does feel like, at this point, you could retell Gentle Rogue, right? I mean, and say it. I'm doing a retelling of Gentle Rogue. And no one's ever said that. And think about that. Also, now I'm blowing my own mind. Because think about that. Like, what a cool thing to be able to take a text that is in many ways problematic, right? In all the ways when we did season two, we spent so much time saying, like, oh, this book was written whenever it was, and, like, there are problematic elements, but let's unpack them. Like, what a cool way to say, like, I'm going to take the Flame and the Flower and rewrite that story for a new time.
I think adaptation, okay, I'm going to make my first, like, instinct is to tell you that adaptation, when you're doing things that are more recent, works better when you're changing medium.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Like, there's a reason, like, Pride and Prejudice is a retelling we can do because it's, right? So a novel-to-novel retelling feels like it would be harder. Because I think it would be harder for people to crawl past their own, right? Like, how do you get to the retelling space?
Right. Or maybe it needs to be a juggernaut, right? It needs to be Twilight. And so you can take Twilight and make 50 Shades.
Right.
Whoa.
I have some thinking to do.
Me too.
I mean, like, but that's true, right? Because you could take Twilight and make Beautiful Bastard. Right. Which isn't shifting medium, but it is shifting genres. I don't know. Now I've let, we're a minute, we're an hour and 25 minutes in, and now
we're just going to leave it with everybody's, we blew your minds.
So, yeah, I think it's probably some sort of juggernaut thing.
Good talk, everybody. Good talk.
Look, everyone needs to go read Love at First because it's magnificent.
Oh, thanks.
It is, I mean, like, it is truly a beautiful, magnificent book.
And please, if Romeo and Juliet is not your thing, don't let that worry you.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, don't. It's, yeah. I mean, balconies are your thing, right?
So, who hates a balcony?
Are your thing. Sexy yeah. towel Rex. I'm sorry, but it's
there's a feral cat.
Yes.
There's an amazing secondary love story.
There's something for everyone. There's a picnic on a lake.
There's an amazing secondary love story. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
Something for everyone, frankly.
Yeah. Handsome doctor. Yeah.
Well, five times a charm, folks.
Yeah.
Wait, Kate.
Yeah.
Tell everyone, so if they order today from Fountain Books, can they get a signed copy?
They can still get a signed copy, yes. I will continue to go back to Fountain and sign books, so if you would like a signed
That's
copy.
Kate's local independent bookstore. Please support local independence as we are in a pandemic.
They've got a special page for Love at First, so please feel free to go there.
You can buy it if you are snowed in. You can get it for your e-reader of choice right now. Next week, we are back reading
A Matter of Class by Mary Bailo.
I've just been rereading some Mary Bailo.
I've never read Mary Bailo.
You haven't?
Whoa. I mean, this is a real... This is not necessarily where I would have started you, but we're doing it.
I just re-listened to Slightly Dangerous.
I am fully capable of jumping into like the Mary Bailo deep end. I feel okay about it.
I mean, Mary Bailo, she's a classic. So we're gonna read that next week. It's a short novel, so you should be fine. And what else? Find us at fatedmates.net. We're produced by Eric Mortensen.
Read Love at First.
Read a Kate Claiborne book.
Thanks for having me, everybody.
Bye, Kate.
Bye.
Love you.